it's a bad idea, but how can I help myself? Been inside for most this year, and I thought a few drinks, they might help. It's been a while, my dear, dealing with the cards life dealt. I'm still holding back these tears, but my friends are somewhere else. I pictured this year a little bit different. When it hit February, a step in the bar, it hit me so hard. Why can it be this heavy? Every song reminds me you're gone, and I feel the lump form in my throat, 'cause I'm here alone. Just dancing with my eyes closed, 'cause everywhere I look I still see you. And time is moving so slow, and I don't know what else that I can do. So I'll keep dancing with my eyes. Is here again, and I think you'll come home soon. A word brings me right back in. Then it's only me that's in this room. I guess I could just pretend the colors are more than blue, but I lost more than my friend. I can't help but missing you. I pictured this month a little bit different. No one is ever ready, and when it unfolds, you get in a hole. Oh, how can it be this heavy? Everything changes, nothing's the same, except the truth is now you're gone. Life just goes on. So I'm dancing with my eyes closed. It's everywhere I look, I still see you. Time is moving so slow, and I don't know what else that I can do. So I'll keep dancing with my eyes. Ay, 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 ay. Shutting the bar, they're cleaning the floor, and everyone is already home, but I'm on my own. Still dancing with my eyes closed. 'Cause everywhere I look, I still see you. Time is moving so slow, and I don't know what else that I can do. So I'll keep dancing with my eyes.
And welcoming you, dear listeners, here to your Sunday morning sessions here on your number one talk radio station. This is the particular time frame where we once again do start off your Sunday morning programming with my Sunday morning take, which will have you in my company from 5 a.m. up till 7 a.m., where we obviously take a look at everything interesting regarding what has happened in history. What has happened in science, what has happened in geography, and a little bit of everything else in between, in order to get a better grasp and an understanding of the particular, you know, events or what has actually happened with regards to the particular developments that we've seen happening around us. Now, for this morning's session, we're going a little bit of the space-y, or a little bit of scientific in its own right, because we're going to have a look specifically this morning at the James Hubble, not the James Hubble, sorry, that was the James Webb that I wanted to, I almost gave the Hubble Space Telescope a different name, but yeah, we're going to be looking at the Hubble Telescope for this morning's session, primarily with its particular important journey that it has so far, you know, taken and provided the valuable information, data back to Earth, because obviously it seems, in terms of even like the same similar particular kind of productions that, okay, not productions, but installations rather, that we have spoken about, and specifically with regards to research and development from a scientific or space science perspective, is that sometimes having a telescope on the surface of the Earth is not the best or most ideal scenario to try and observe and also try to get the best, if you can say, collection of data and information. Sometimes you've got to send a probe into space and then tell the probe, hey, listen, go and fly a little bit further than what you are actually, you know, here to do. And primarily that is what the Hubble Space Telescope has done so far. And I mean, it, since being launched in the 90s, it has provided, knowledge and data that we would not have gotten if we were just prone to observing telescopes or no. Not just observing telescopes, observing through telescopes from the surface of the Earth, because primarily it makes it a little bit more challenging. But we'll quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and we come back right after this.
I wish that I could change the weather, enjoy the sound of silence in my car. There's things I just can't hate forever. I find a crowded place to fall apart. You could pay me on any idea. You could pay me on a tangerine dream. You can pay me on a space bar. Pay me on Jackie. Pay me on Dexy. Oh.
Come back from the quicker than ever musical break there with the Empire of the Sun with the song Music on the Radio. It's a good thing they probably don't listen to the music that I offer up. But yeah, it gets us into the rest of this morning session here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And obviously, if you've just woken up, good morning, good morning, good morning. I do hope that you've got a cup of hot something in your hand. Winter is upon us, or is trying to, stake its claim over us, obviously, in one way or another. I'm obviously sitting here with a massive jacket in the studio. Not that it, is so cold here in the Kleinwinter area, because where I came from, it was, super duper cold. But however, In terms of, stepping away from the meteorological discussion here, where we left off just before the break finds ourselves in a lovely scenario in terms of understanding that primarily, yesterday, technically yesterday's date, not today's date, was the particular celebration of, celebration in extent, but more like, honoring on 25 April, the placement into operation, not the launch, but the placement into operation of the Hubble Space Telescope, which was named for the, after the foremost American astronomer of the 20th century. And it was put into operation by the crew of the space shuttle Discovery. And this was the first sophisticated optical observatory that was placed into orbit around Earth. And it was built in the United States under the supervision of NASA. Now the Hubble, has its own particular, primary sort of like function. Primarily looking at what the Hubble technically tries to achieve versus conventional sort of like technology on the surface of the planet. And I'm not saying conventional as in what you can buy from your shop or what you can get from a specifically for your own particular stargazing habit or hobby. I'm talking about the massive telescopes, for example, and the observation stations, for example, like the one here outside Windhoek to the south of Windhoek, here in the Gamsberg area, where they do observe the heavens. And obviously that would be like the second one that, would be installed between the agreement between UNAM and the Radboud, university regarding space, observation. That obviously will help Namibian students and Namibian scientists in the realm of space also have access primarily if they are obviously associated to, one of the parties in that particular agreement, which i.e. which we UNAM in that regard. But we see a interesting scenario in terms of also the balance between having that and having, for example, something like the Hubble. Now, what the Hubble provides in terms of its overall benefit, its overall motivation, is that the Hubble would be free from Earth's atmosphere, because any observation installation on the surface of Earth is probably going to have to deal with various kinds of interferences. Now, it's not to say remove the atmosphere. The atmosphere is the single most important thing that's actually keeping us alive, from us, keeping us alive from the harmful sunlight rays. And I'm talking about they are literally like super harmful if we didn't have the atmosphere above us. Second scenario that you've got to take into consideration as to why the Hubble was launched was that because of the atmosphere around us, the atmosphere has got a lot of interfering elements. So we're talking about things from the ultraviolet light, because if you take light... I had to read up on the experiment that was done specifically regarding the four kinds of particles that you find in sunlight. The sunlight that you see around you, that illuminates your world, that gives you direction to where you can go to, how you can see other things, and so on and so forth, is that there are like four main categories of light within one sunlight ray. You find ultraviolet light, you find, ultraviolet is UV, then you find the other one that has radiation in it. All of them have radiation in it. Then there are two more that I, you know, that I keep forgetting, but they are also like very well known. The most important thing is that, these formats of particles in our atmosphere also interrupts technically with the ground stations here on the planet, you know, with the ground equipment that tries to look through the atmosphere into space and then try to get a solid signal. What the Hubble does is literally take that observation initiative and you put it in space outside of Earth's atmosphere. So the most important thing is that free from Earth's atmosphere, the Hubble actually captures clearer and more detailed images than ground-based telescopes. And this largely reflects, this large reflecting telescope also gathers light from celestial objects using its mirror optics and it directs it to the cameras and the spectrographs on the spacecraft itself. So, since the Hubble is known as the first, there's a second one that had been launched, just after COVID, I think it was 2021, the James Webb. The Webb was launched literally after COVID. So the Hubble seems to be still in operation. I say seems because, it's been there for so long in space. It has provided so much particular understanding regarding what the size of our universe is, where our universe finds itself. There's a few scary stuff that the Hubble also discovered, a few not so scary stuff. And there's also a particular scenario in terms of, you know, what happens to the Hubble, you know, after its last broadcast probably takes place. Yes, it is broadcasting, or it does broadcast. But the Hubble in its own right has surpassed, you know, expectations probably, you know, from the scientific perspective in its various own ways. Now, since the Hubble is a telescope that is stationed in outer space, it is entirely above the atmosphere, as I mentioned, because the atmosphere has got a lot of interfering elements within it. And it makes it difficult for any observation equipment on the surface of the Earth to actually get a clear picture of a lot of things. And you've also got to understand that Earth spins on its own axis. So that's also another particular thing that you've got to look into. However, the reception of the kinds of photos and recordings that the Hubble has done provides greater brightness, clarity, and detail than any ground-based telescopes with similar optical equipment would ever do. Now, the Hubble was actually a approval, obviously, of the United States Congress back in 1977, which authorized its particular construction. If you did not know, NASA is an SOE of the United States. It is a public enterprise of the American government. So it does have to present budgets to the U.S. Congress. Now, the Hubble Space Telescope was built under the supervision of the organization known as NASA, its full name being the National Aeronautics and Space Administration of the United States. And it was named after Edwin Hubble, who was the foremost American astronomer of the 20th century. Now, the HST, which is the name we're going to use for it, you know, interchangeably with Hubble during this morning's discussion, was placed into orbit about 600 kilometers above Earth by the crew of the space shuttle Discovery on 25 April 1990. Now, the Hubble, if you have to think about it, and if you've ever wanted to know what it looks like, actually, is a few descriptions about it. It is a large reflecting telescope whose mirror optics, so it's got a whole bunch of, is that solar panels? Yeah. It's got like two solar panels that look like fish fins. Then it has got like a particular flap. If I open it up, it's got a particular flap at the back end of it known as an aperture door. So technically you have to know that speaks towards that somewhere there's a camera in that particular vicinity. It's got a radio antenna. It's got a secondary mirror. A mirror helps it also to capture certain kinds of data that you don't easily see with your eye. I mentioned the solar panels indeed. It's got a camera in the front of the particular device itself. The Hubble is not a small thing. It's probably the size of a house in many scenarios. It's got a few other particular measurement equipment known as spectrographs. And it's got and then it's got a primary mirror that helps with other kinds with the, you know, first round of observation and data analysis or data collection rather that it's got to, you know, capture. So as you look at the Hubble, it might look like a satellite in some cases, but it's not a satellite. It's actually a telescope, because that's how the NASA guys design their stuff. They all have a similar shape. I still don't know. It's probably with James Webb that they did actually change the design layout, why the James Webb looks the way it technically does with, you know, probably being in similar size to the Hubble. But the James Webb in its own right, is, should I rather say, yeah. I mean, the James Webb looks like a, you know, a, it just looks weird. Because primarily the design of the James Webb versus the design of the Hubble is that the James Webb looks, I almost said a Petri dish, but it's a Petri dish is what they use there in the science labs. It looks like someone's, you know, these finger foods that you find at small it's a cocktail. It looks like a cocktail food piece. The James Webb Space Telescope in its own right. Why am I calling it a cocktail piece, a cocktail food piece? I mean, it just primarily goes against the norm of the designs that we became used to that had been sent up into space. Anything from satellites to, you know, the first Hubble telescope and, the particular sort of like, you know, overall design and layout. Now, not to sort of like take our discussion of our own particular path of conversation. The Hubble itself, since, you know, we now know that back in 25 April 1990, it was literally set into motion, specifically 600 kilometers above Earth's atmosphere in order to get the ball going in terms of let's send these deep space probes. Now, deep space probing has also seen various particular probes being sent to Mars. We've had here on My Sunday Morning Take the conversation about the Soviet probes to Venus. Yeah, to Venus. Primarily to try and understand what's going on the planet of Venus. They sent a whole bunch, I think it was like 10 or 11 probes, to Venus. So in the spirit of understanding the cosmos or the cosmos around us and what's actually happening in space around Earth, one of the biggest questions obviously that you'll sometimes see if you've ever seen these documentaries by the scientists, associated to NASA or, you know, if they are academics, who follow the developments regarding, space science, is that in many scenarios, the discussion is one of, are we alone? Yeah, really guys, they ask this question. It's a hypothesis that they've got in the analysis. In many scenarios, the aim is to try and find other signs of life. The Hubble, the James Webb, they will tell you we want to go and actually measure space and time in space around us. But at the sort of like at the back end of that question, that first hypothesis question, there's a whole range of questions that lead up to one question at the end. Are we alone? In many scenarios, it is a yes. I won't scare you with the other one that that came about here just after COVID as well, here about 2022, when one scientist literally said, you know what, guys, just also consider this possibility. It's a possibility that you first have to prove in order to understand, and then after proving it, you have to then ask the question about, you know, whether or not this is actually a reality. Is this real? Now, the Hubble itself, or getting back onto the subject matter of the Hubble itself, which is designed as a large reflecting telescope with its mirror optics that gather light from celestial objects, and directs it into the two cameras and the two spectrographs, which separate radiation into a spectrum and then record the spectrums. The Hubble has a 2.4 meter primary mirror. So as you can see, it's a pretty big thing. 2.4 meters is probably bigger than this door in front of me. And yeah, it's got these particular measurement tools on it that helps it to do the recording of what's literally in space. The second, of these, if the extension to the description of the 2.4 meter is also that the Hubble also has various other recording instruments that can detect visible, ultraviolet, and infrared. Yeah, that's the other light. Infrared light, in order to, you know, understand what's the actual situation with regarding, you know, what's in space. The most important of these instruments is also the wide field planetary camera. It can take either wide field or high resolution images of planets and of galactic and extragalactic objects. And this particular camera is also designed to achieve image resolutions 10 times greater than that of even the largest Earth-based telescope. Now, I've got to explain to you guys that this particular camera is massive. I'll say it again. It's massive. Why am I saying it's massive? Well, just to put the conversation into context now. The design of the Hubble itself, was obviously to try and see, you know what, it's something that needs to be able to withstand the sub-zero cold temperatures of space. Now, if you are trying to understand still in 2026, you know, what does space consist of, and, you know, is there light, is there oxygen, is there anything? Light is a matter of opinion in terms of how you look at it, to your observation skills. There's definitely no oxygen there. And if you're asking literally whether or not we are floating in space, that would also be a matter of an opinion that you can, you know, reach, because the jury is still, okay, even though there is a hypothesis that is, or the theory, not a hypothesis, let me rather say the theory. Even though the theory is and has become more plausible with regards to how we need to look at space, on whether or not we are floating, whether or not we are standing still, or whether or not we are actually falling. Now, the falling theory has become the most mainstream theory in the realm of space science, primarily because they looked at the Big Bang theory. They looked at the distance between the planets, the distance of the planets in our solar system from the sun, which is a star, the life of the star, which is our sun, how long it's still gonna live for. And if you guys did not know, our sun will die. It's not a thing that will, you know, be there for it. Yeah, in your eternity. Yeah, in your life and in my life. Yeah, sure. The sun will still be there. It won't be anything recent. Don't worry, guys. It's just the scenario in terms of how you need to look at space, in that everything has a lifespan to it. And a lifespan means it's probably going to stop at one other time. Now, since the design of the Hubble has to contend with these conditions that I've just explained to you, sub-zero conditions out in space, having to pick up various kinds of data particles, and I say data particles because in some cases it is mostly light, various forms of light that it has to deal with. And remember, the experiment that I was recently shown is that one of the planets, if you look up into your sky, one of the planets is a fixed installation. It's actually the first of the planets that you'll always see when you look up at the sky. To you, it'll look like a star. In actual fact, it is a planet. And that you can see the other planet in right opposite it, in terms of, you know, across. If you're looking in one direction, you just have to look at the other direction to look for a fixed planet sitting in a specific fixed position. So it helps to broaden our understanding. It helps to broaden the particular field of view that we've got. And the aim of some of the equipment is that the faint object camera can detect an object 50 times fainter than anything observable by any ground-based telescopes, meaning that a faint object spectrograph also gathers data on the object's chemical composition. So the moment that camera sees it, the spectrograph then analyzes it in terms of seeing, okay, what kind of a thing is this? It also includes a high-resolution spectrograph that receives distant object ultraviolet light. So any object that's very distant will be deflecting or reflecting some light from its surface. And this particular long-distance or high-resolution spectrograph aims to then capture, you know, if you see something reflecting or deflecting light, you'll be able to see it and you'll be able to analyze it from a distance. And this is primarily also a scenario in terms of the benefit of having a floating, you know, space telescope in space, so that it can actually analyze and gather data of these various items that are hanging there in space. Now, an interesting thing, obviously, as always, as it always happens, specifically with space, is that there are some few interesting developments that sometimes pop up. Because about a month after the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope, which technically is like 25 May, it became apparent that the Hubble's large primary mirror had been ground to the wrong shape owing to faulty testing procedures by the mirror's manufacturer. Now, this resulted in an optical defect, meaning that spherical aberration, which caused the mirror to produce fuzzy rather than sharp images, meaning the way it was installed onto the Hubble itself meant that the light wasn't captured at the right angle. It was actually captured at the incorrect angle. And this meant that all images looked fuzzy, meaning it was a waste of time, basically. Now, the Hubble was also developed problems with its gyroscopes. A gyroscope is, it helps with stability issues. So let's, for example, say if you have to turn a camera remotely in a certain direction, a gyroscope helps to keep the camera stable. If you guys have ever seen cameramen and camera women stand with a tripod and a camera, in some cases they've got to turn the camera, you know, like in a very steady manner, left and right. I'm calling it turning, but the actual word is panning. You've got to pan left and then pan right. And then there's the up and down movement of the camera. All of that has to be smooth. But how do you achieve that smoothness? You achieve it with that tripod. Now, the tripod doesn't have a gyroscope in it, just so that you know. But the tripod does replicate a function that was found in gyroscopes. And interesting enough, guys, gyroscopes actually came from a war setting. Just so that you know. Gyroscopes was something, I think, that the Americans invented for their tanks in the Second World War. The explanation that if you ever look up what a gyroscope is, the explanation it gives you would be something in the line of that it measures or maintains an orientation or an angular velocity by using a rapidly spinning wheel or a vibrating structure based on the principles of angular momentum. They are essential for stability, navigation, and guidance. You sometimes also find it in consumer electronics, but a gyroscope, just so that you know, it's not... It didn't have a positive introduction in human history. Gyroscopes come from a military setting. And gyroscopes were the first instance in terms of, for example, how the American tanks, the Shermans of the Second World War, how the American tanks could drive and stay level. If you've ever seen this, it is what a gyroscope does. You can drive. Your suspension will be moving, but the turret and the barrel of the tank stays level. That's what a gyroscope does. In other scenarios, you know, other nations obviously developed a different scenario in terms of they call it gun depression. Gun depression sometimes is about how low can you aim. That's how far can the barrel be pushed downwards into the ground and how far up. In some scenarios, some countries produced this technology where it was, you know, rather use hydraulic shocks. I think the Swedes and the Finns developed something like that for their particular tanks. There was a tank that the Swedes developed. I know I'm completely off track from the Hubble Space Telescope, guys, but just in terms of explaining to you that it's actually using technology that comes from the Second World War. The Swedes developed a tank, that doesn't need a gyroscope. Well, first and foremost, the tank does not have a turret, to be honest. A turret is the thing that turns left and right and can turn all around. It doesn't have a turret, and this particular tank, on its bed is as flat as you could possibly think, just with the turret sticking out. However, the tank has got a whole bunch of hydraulics within it. Hydraulics to lift its front, hydraulics to drop its front, hydraulics to stabilize it in a correct position, and you know, in various scenarios, you find technology playing different roles for the same particular purpose. And the Americans love their gyroscopes.
other countries, for example, like the Swedes, just play around with other mechanics around the design and build of their own military hardware. But we come back from that piece of negative description regarding gyroscopes and the likes with hydraulics from the Second World War. But we're going to take a musical break, guys, and we come back right after this here on your number one talk radio station. This is my Sunday morning take. This is Eagle FM, and you're in our company from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. If you've just woken up, please remember to have a hot drink in your hand. And I'm not talking about anything that has the potential of intoxicating you, but just, you know, a regular hot drink. On that note, we'll be back right after this.
Just I'm always wondering what it would be like to die. She asks me why. I always smile when I feel like I'm gonna cry. She asks me why. Over the cliff in phantom sands, she's always offering me her hand. And I hear her coming through the echoes, through the echoes. Everything that she sees shines in the sky, up there shining. When your belly's wrong, you're down the phone. When you ask for bread, you get a stone. When you feel like you're alone, listen for me coming through the echo.
Back there, specific from the sounds of Paolo Nutini with the song Through the Echoes, we find ourselves close to or at 6 a.m. That obviously being the midway point for this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take. If you've just woken up, good morning. If you've been with us since the start of the program, thank you. And as we always do, we provide you with the interesting discussions here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM, as we obviously look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between. Now, obviously, we left off at the Hubble Space Telescope's particular unique, equipment that it's got with it. But, in terms of activity towards it regarding, trying to fix a few things that seemed to be out of place and to correct what was supposed to have been correct from the start. There have been three
space missions or shuttle missions to the Hubble Space Telescope's particular, you know, or to it primarily by the, you know, the ground stations who realize that certain particular equipment are not acting in line with what they're supposed to do. So, three subsequent space shuttle missions in 1997, 99, and 2002 helped to repair the Hubble's gyroscopes. And it also added new instruments that included a new or a near infrared spectrometer and a wide field camera. The final space shuttle mission to the Hubble was intended to install a new camera and an ultraviolet spectrograph, and it was launched in 2009. Now, the Hubble itself is scheduled to remain operational up until 2021 was its last sort of like envisaged, you know, time frame of being active, and after which it is expected to be replaced, or was replaced by the James Webb Space Telescope, which was equipped with a mirror 7 times larger than that of the Hubble. So, the Hubble's discoveries have also helped with astronomy in terms of helping to describe certain particular phenomena that we can't see from Earth's surface. For example, it took the photo of NGC 604 Nebula. This is a specific location in space. And if you don't know what a nebula is a specific kind of a celestial body, primarily that it, highlights a specific kind of a status of, you know, where certain celestial bodies are. Now, a nebula is known as a distinct luminescent part of an interstellar medium, which can consist of ionized, neutral, or molecular hydrogen and also cosmic dust. Just to let you know. And obviously when looking at nebulas, they look like a giant cloud of dust and gas in space. Now some nebulae, which is more than one nebula, come from the gas and dust thrown out by the explosions of a dying star, such as a supernova. And other nebulae are regions where new stars are beginning to form. So a nebula can be one of two things. A nebula can be the sign of a grave site of a recently exploding supernova or recently exploded supernova. And a nebula can also be technically a birth of a new star starting to form, starting to take shape. So a nebula can be one of two things, one of a grave site and one of a place of birth, which is actually very, very philosophic in its own right. If you think about it, primarily that it can resemble, you know, the end or the start of something. Pretty awesome. Really awesome. Now, the NGC 604 nebula, which was a nebula that the Hubble Space Telescope took a photo of, it was calculated of being 2.7 million light years away in the constellation Triangulum. Just to let you guys know, 1 light year, is the equivalent of, let's just get this right. 1 light year. No. So 1 light year is about, okay, it's a whole bunch of millions or billions of light years. So yeah, that is the problem with, you know, understanding the maths around the discussion of what a light year is. So, yeah, okay. 1 light year is technically 9.46 trillion kilometers. A light year is also a distance of light, or that a light is also the distance that light travels in 1 year. That is what a light year is, because that's the only measurement that they could use, primarily in terms of how far can we see something and how can we reach it. So if you ever need to understand, dear listeners, what is a light year? What constitutes a light year? Just know that it's a lot of time. It's a lot of time. As mentioned, a light year is the distance that light from the sun travels. And they basically use that with us, with Earth. So, light apparently travels at a speed of 186,000 miles, or if you want to be a little bit more fancy, 300,000 kilometers per second, which is very fast. And obviously also to understand this, that one light year, as mentioned, is the 9.46 trillion kilometers. Just need to be sure about this. That's 100,730,000,460,000,000,000. Yeah, 9.46 trillion kilometers is one light year. Tell you guys, completely fascinating stuff. Completely fascinating. So 2.7 million light years is super far away. Now, that's just one of the particular nebulae or celestial entities that the Hubble Space Telescope had taken photos of. They obviously had to add some color to it, you know, so it looks like a color photo representation. One of the other particular things is also the observations of Cepheid variables. Cepheid variables are basically kinds of celestial bodies that have been seen. It's one of the class of variable stars whose periods of variation are closely related to the luminosity, meaning how bright it shines, and that are also therefore useful in measuring interstellar and intergalactic distances. So if a Cepheid variable is observed by the Hubble or now by James Webb, they would be able to measure the distance from other systems or other solar systems or other stars or other planets, and also be able to establish distance, not just from us, but from all other particular entities and so on, and then try to observe certain things, for example, like any movements taking place. Now, the interesting thing about a Cepheid variable, as mentioned, not just about the distances, and about its luminosity, and also, you know, how to try to map out space. Because technically what the James Webb and the Hubble are doing is they are busy helping us map space. Now, most of these Cepheid variables are spectral type 4, which is moderately hot at maximum luminosity, and type G, which is cooler and sun-like at minimum. And obviously, you know, many of them have been observed before and have been labeled. For example, the first of these Cepheid variables have been the prototype star, which is Delta Cephei. It was a variable of which was discovered by John Goodrick in 1784, and in 1912, Henrietta Leavitt of Harvard Observatory discovered the aforementioned period luminosity relationship of Cepheids. So, we discover things every day, guys. Now, so when they obviously look at the observations of Cepheid variables in nearby galaxies, which is a particular activity that allows the observers here on Earth's surface to make accurate determinations of what the Hubble is actually measuring. And then they also have to look at a rate of the universe's expansion, which is, like I explained to you at the start of the discussion, the reason as to why the James Webb and the Hubble are in space is because the scientists want to know, is our universe expanding? Are the planets moving away from the sun? Are certain anomalies happening? I read something interesting yesterday, specifically that the planet known as Pluto still has to make one full cycle in its entire life, in your entire life, in my entire life. Pluto has not yet gone around the sun, ever. In human history, since human history has looked up at the sky, Pluto has not made a rotation around the sun in 250 years of, well, let's make it 400 years since Galileo. Because Galileo was the guy that came up with the particular theories about Earth is not flat, Earth does not spin around the sun, the sun doesn't spin around Earth, it does the opposite, Earth spins around the sun, and Galileo was the guy that started seeing planets with his own telescope in his own backyard in Pisa. The fabled city that also has the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Now, as you can obviously identify, telescopes were the go-to instruments that us as humanity have used in terms of trying to measure and look at the heavens and then obviously try to make our judgments and discussions from there. I think it's the same thing primarily as to why at the start of this year we received here in Namibia the satellite observation or the satellite monitoring station here outside Windhoek. Just on the other side of here is Acre, the one that was handed over or donated by the Chinese to us. Obviously, a satellite monitoring station is slightly different from a telescope looking at just the heavens. But a satellite monitoring station also helps with something. It also adds its weight into one or other aspect. The Gamsberg observation station, if for many of you don't have the opportunity of seeing it primarily, but it is unique. The Gamsberg observation has got massive. They're technically telescopes, but they look like satellite dishes. And the reason why they've got to do that is they've got to capture as much data as possible. As much data as possible. And Namibia does have an ideal position on Earth in terms of its view to the skies. That was one of the presentations that obviously that visiting professor from Radboud highlighted. But Namibia kept losing out to Chile from the 70s up until even into the early 2000s. We kept losing out to Chile because it seemed like Chile was the most preferred position or the most preferred southern hemisphere location. Only now are we starting to convince, the world that we also have a place in space science. With space science development, space science research and observation, and probably also crunching the numbers that we can provide our own weight in that. Now, the Hubble has also photographed young stars with disks that will eventually become planetary systems. As you obviously need to understand that a star is usually the sun of a system, the main energy source. The Hubble Deep Field, which is a photograph of about 1,500 galaxies that the Hubble has seen, revealed galactic evolution over nearly the entire history of the universe. Within the solar system itself, the Hubble was also used to discover the systems of Hydra and Nix, Okay, no, these were two moons. Sorry. The Hubble was able to discover the two moons of Pluto. Remember Pluto I just mentioned? Because Pluto was, what was it? Just before COVID, Pluto was declassified as a planet. Pluto was declassified as a planet because of its size, and some of the scientists felt like Pluto was a waste of space, technically, in terms of trying to observe it because it's so far away. The downside of Pluto's predicament is that Pluto is so far in the channel of planets that have to get light from the sun. The first four of us, obviously, we're the guys being baked. You know, that's us, that's Mars, that's Venus. I think there's a planet right in front of Venus. Since we are the third planet from the sun, there's planet in front of Venus, then us, then Mars behind us, and then come the big guys, Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune. Yeah, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune. I think it's Mercury that's the first one. So Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune are the guys after Mars. And yeah. The particular interesting thing has been that the Hubble has discovered that Pluto actually has two moons, Nix and Hydra. As you know, that Pluto is called a dwarf planet because of its size in comparison to its other siblings in our system. And it has its own particular traits. Now, we quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and we come back right after that, heading into the rest of this morning's program here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And this is my Sunday morning take on this, it seems now not to be a chilly Sunday morning session. But don't worry, we still have the rest of the Sunday morning to judge that.
much for us to have enough.
We come back there with the songs there of, or the sound there specifically of St. Raymond with the song Gone By Morning. Before that, you had a little bit of a classic known by Sade, the Smooth Operator. And yes, you're still here. Lovely Sunday morning sessions. And obviously, we'll also give you some good particular tunes and discussion content regarding what's happening around the world as... Okay, besides the antics that Donald Trump is trying to make, I swear, guys, ever since, you know, he came back into office, I've never seen such particular news generation happening where everything around the world, literally everything in the world, revolves around this guy's decision making. I've never seen it. It's a level of narcissism that I don't know what's going on here. I really don't know. It's literally like the United States wants to be the sun in our solar system and the rest of us just have to orbit around it. I don't know. I've never seen such level of orbiting going on, because technically speaking, the rules of the solar system don't apply in politics. But as we obviously find ourselves here once again in the My Sunday Morning Take, where we obviously step away from those kinds of discussions and we obviously have a look primarily into what the Hubble Space Telescope has achieved, is that it has provided a lot of particular, you know, insight into the realm. Now, the Hubble has taken a few, you know, considerable images. It is known as having a 35-year history so far, technically. It has celebrated its 35th anniversary. I think that was last year, but technically this would also be the 36th anniversary for itself. The Hubble has still been sending photos, I think. Yeah, it still says here on NASA's particular dedicated website on the Hubble's contributions. Some of them are beautiful. Some of them are wonderful photography, you know, aspects. Others are puzzling. And if you didn't have a trained eye, for example, like the astronomers and the scientists that have the opportunity of looking at these photos, then they would be, they would just be a weird photo to you. However, in the 35 years of the images that the Hubble has sent back to Earth, they've obviously, you know, provided scenarios in terms of, you know, confirming a lot of particular biases. One of the biggest biases that I still don't know where it comes from. I know where it comes from because I've read up on the subject matter, but I still don't know till today where it comes from and why it is still being reinforced and why it actually got even stronger right after COVID, because a whole bunch of us probably were just locked up and we just decided to believe the flat earth theory once again, even though the Hubble took a photo that earth is not flat. I'll let it resonate there. I'll just let it marinate. And for those of you that believe the flat earth theory, go look at the Hubble's website. You go look at its photos. You'll enjoy it. It's beauty that you've never seen before. But before we actually continue, guys, we're going to take a short break.
Don't spend all your hard-earned money. Get quality food at USAFE. 4 100-gram clover-flavored daily snacks. Just 20 Namibian dollars for two. That's 8 100-gram cups. 2 liters Koi soft drinks. Only 12.99 Namibian dollars each. 600 grams Hazeldine mixed fruit jam. 29.99 Namibian dollars. Knosso, just 25 Namibian dollars for 5 packets. Save 10 Namibian dollars. 700 grams Nola mayonnaise. 39.99 Namibian dollars. USAFE. Where good food costs less. Don't spend all your hard-earned money. Get quality food at USAFE. 4 100-gram clover-flavored daily snacks. Just 20 Namibian dollars for two. That's 8 100-gram cups. 2 liters Koi soft drinks. Only 12.99 Namibian dollars each. 600 grams Hazeldine mixed fruit jam. 29.99 Namibian dollars. Knosso, just 25 Namibian dollars for 5 packets. Save 10 Namibian dollars. 700 grams Nola mayonnaise. 39.99 Namibian dollars. USAFE. Where good food costs less. Don't spend all your hard-earned money. Get quality food at USAFE. 4 100-gram clover flavored.
Now we come back from the sort of like short ad break right there, and where we find ourselves primarily in the, if I can call it sort of like the, this morning's session primarily of my Sunday morning take is that, okay, actually where we left off just before the break was proving the flat earth is wrong with just a basic photograph from the Hubble. There is obvious curvature. Curvature implying the earth is obviously round. And one of the most particular important developments, obviously, to identify is that from this scenario, what you can obviously see is a discussion of realizing, seeing, and being able to discern, you know, what is right in front of us all, primarily with regards to what has been obvious. The earth is not flat. I just had to rub that in the face there of the flat earthers. The earth is not flat, guys. So, obviously, the other particular lovely developments was that in the first year of the Hubble's flight, it observed a storm on the planet of Saturn. Now, Saturn is one of the planets in our solar system that has the rings around it. It looks like a... Yeah, it just has rings around it. Basically, that it doesn't look like anything else. It looks like Saturn. Now, what Hubble realized was that literally as it was observing a storm taking place on Saturn. The storm primarily, or the images that later on revealed the storm from the Hubble in its first year of flight, was that it showed that Saturn's white had a white particular spot on it, and that a great storm on the planet's equatorial region. So the equatorial region would literally be the line that cuts across the planet and cuts it in a perfect half, technically from its bottom and its top, perfect halves. And then on its equatorial region of Saturn, the planet was busy experiencing a storm. Now, it was discovered by amateur astronomers in September of 1990. And such storms that were observed specifically in these first photos that the Hubble took of Saturn were considered to be rare because the last previous storm that Saturn apparently had was in 1933. The previous storm on its equatorial region on Saturn was in 1933. A whole 90 years or, no, 60 years. No, not 60. A whole 90 years. No, 60 years. A whole 60 years in the opposite direction from 1990. Now, the storm extended completely around the planet. Yes, it completely extended around the planet. It literally followed its equatorial line around the planet. So, meaning this was... Imagine a storm so big, guys, on planet Earth. A storm so big, it runs from one side of the planet to the other side of the planet. But technically, it just, you know, circumnavigates itself and links up to itself. And the storm is just stuck in that region. Imagine the chaos on such a planet. And the severity of such a storm. Now, in some places, the storm also appeared as great masses of clouds, and in other places, as organized turbulence. Now, the astronomers obviously of NASA, or the, you know, the particular scientists of NASA knew that the storm is probably a once-in-a-lifetime event, and the scientists and the engineers of the special white spot observing team, and also the Wide Field Planetary Camera team and the Space Telescope Science Institute, you know, another particular entity known as the Goddard Space Flight Center, reprogrammed the Hubble's observing schedule and were able to get several days of Saturn observations in mid-November of 1990, shortly before before Saturn moved too near in the sky to the sun for safe observations by the Hubble. So the Hubble brought us new knowledge that Saturn experiences a storm so big it crosses the planet. A storm so big, you can see it from space. A storm so powerful that you could literally consider Saturn to be volatile, having volatile atmosphere or volatile climatic conditions. Another particular discovery from the Hubble's particular archive of the photos that it took was that in its second year, the astronomers reported in 1992 that they found intriguing evidence that a black hole weighing about 2.6 billion times the size or the mass of the sun. Oh my goodness, 2.6 billion times the size. Or the mass of the sun. The mass of the sun. Guys, the sun is big. Nah. And if there's a measurement of 2.6 billion times the mass of the sun, it is big. It is big. So the Hubble discovered that there was a black hole that exists at the center of the giant elliptical galaxy M87. Let me say it again. There's a black hole existing in the middle of a galaxy known as M87. If you don't know what a black hole is, I suggest you read up a little bit. But in essence, a black hole is a vacuum. Think of it as a vacuum cleaner. Literally, just think of it as a vacuum cleaner. And the recent knowledge that has been developed around what black holes actually do and what they constitute is that black holes destroy information. So what does that mean? Since it sucks in or absorbs any positive information, for example, the existence of a planet, the existence of other particular celestial bodies and the likes, black holes destroy that information. So black holes are a negative. Now, you can't say that they are bad because they are natural. I'll say it again. You can't say that a black hole is a negative because a black hole exists naturally in the solar systems. Now, the galaxy of M87... was obviously also observed by the Hubble, and the images saw that the stars become strongly concentrated towards the center of M87, as if it is drawn into the center and held there by the gravitational field of the massive black hole. Now, M87 is at the center of a nearby cluster of galaxies in the constellation of Virgo, which is 52 million light years away. And it contains more than 100 billion stars. One of the biggest galaxies in the local universe is M87, and it is visible in even small telescopes. Year 3. The Hubble, obviously they're showing us the most artistic photos, because I'm obviously looking at it here in front of me. The Hubble also took a photo of M42's gas plume and its prop lids. So the Hubble took a photo of a hypersonic shockwave, which is also depicted in this photo that I've got here in front of me, of material that moved at 148,000 miles per hour. So that's probably like 160,000 kilometers per hour, 170,000 kilometers per hour, in the Orion Nebula, which is a star-forming region. Remember what a nebula is? It's either a gravesite or it's either a birth site, which is about 1,500 light years away from Earth. And studies of similar objects have indicated that such highly supersonic shock waves are formed by a beam of material coming out of newly formed stars. So it's almost like the residue after construction has finished, you know, like the bricks that are done, the cement, you know, the cement that was spilt everywhere, and the sort of like the after effects of after the construction site had been sorted and all that. It's probably that kind of scenario. So the Hubble realized that nebula that indicate formation of new stars has some highly, you know, some elements that fly at a severe speed in the universe, and primarily that it, you know, seems to come about or happen when a star is about to form. Now, the plume was also measured by the Hubble. And that's now obviously the plume of the gas. Because mentioned, there is gas in space. Not oxygen. Oxygen is only native to the planet Earth. Just other gases. That's why it was mentioned that hydrogen is everywhere. Hydrogen is in space. Hydrogen is on our planet. Hydrogen is everywhere. So, what did we see? Now, the plume was highlighted to be 1,500 years old, and the image that was taken by Hubble is 112 light years across. The particular color in the photograph that they used, because obviously you have to now put it in the various colors and the best one to indicate what's actually going on, consisted of a composite of separate images that were taken at wavelengths of two abundant elements in the nebula, hydrogen and oxygen. Wow, there is oxygen. Look at that, guys. Look at that. Literally, that they could find oxygen also in space. That's awesome. It's just like I said, outside our, you know, hemisphere or climatic conditions, you won't find oxygen. Please, guys, don't think that oxygen is everywhere. You won't find oxygen. And this is in the formation of a nebula. Just that you also know that. In year four itself, the Hubble then observed a star cluster, which is known as R136. Now, in 1994, the Hubble took a photo of a massive young stellar group forming, or stellar grouping, that was called R136. The cluster is only a few million years old, and it actually resides in the 30 Dorados Nebula, another star forming situation probably, where a turbulent star birth region, which is a turbulent star birth region in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And it was from a satellite galaxy, which is a satellite galaxy, in our own Milky Way itself. So what the Hubble took a photo of, it looks beautiful. Obviously they, as I said, they had to put the color photo together because it was a whole bunch of photos that they had to put together to get a proper depiction of what it looks like to your eyes, is that there is no known star forming region in our galaxy as large or as prolific as the 30 Dorados, nebula as it had been observed by our buddy, the Hubble. In year five, the Hubble then also saw a comet impact. So, comets, as you guys know, are a supersized meteor. Let's just, you know, also speak frankly on that subject matter. When I say a supersized meteor, it has the impact, or it has the potential, obviously, to cause great damage on any planet that a comet would crash into, because a comet probably is bigger than a, what's the other one that I'm thinking about? You get a comet, you get an asteroid, yeah. So, in year 5, 1995, the Hubble took a photo of Jupiter, which indicated 8 impact sites from the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 impact in 1994. The comet, which was discovered in 1993, broke into 21 fragments during a close passage by Jupiter in July of 1992. Now, there is also an interesting discussion or theory that has actually popped up in recent, potentially recent, you know, evidence of asteroid and, okay, not asteroid, let me not say asteroids, because asteroids just float in space. Comets and meteors are pretty similar in what they do, meaning they travel through space. So, there was a recent video that came up on specifically on YouTube about how people thought it was AI generated. It still had to be proven whether or not it was actually submitted by or provided by one of the space agencies here on Earth, because they sometimes do have these space agencies also have their own YouTube channels, and they sometimes show live broadcasts. For example, like, you can watch the live broadcast of the International Space Station, just view things, you know, just hanging there in space. It showed this particular video, was back in last month, the month before, in February, something moving on the moon. And this was obviously before the new, the Artemis space program was launched. And what was seen at the explainer in just below the video, the caption just below the video, was it looks like a potential meteor or a maybe an asteroid or one other particular celestial body just crashing into the surface of the moon, but actually traveling across the surface of the moon as well, not just crashing into it but also traveling across it. Now, a theory had highlighted the, you know, the make and the look of our moon is based upon various crashes into its surface by a whole bunch of meteors. Now, remember, when a meteor enters the Earth's surface, it becomes a meteorite. Outside of our surface, it stays a meteor. So, the moon has been bombarded many times by meteors throughout our particular known history as humans, and obviously also well into history, primarily as far back probably as the period right after, or just during when the dinosaurs also existed. So that means a whole couple of million years that way. The moon has been experiencing a lot of, in easier terms, bombardment of meteors and other particular celestial entities. So when this asteroid fragmented in its collision with Jupiter, the astronomers could observe the crash sites, or the impact sites rather, not the crash sites. The impact sites on the face of Jupiter, or on the planet surface of Jupiter. Then, in year six, one of those particularly colorful photos, also of the Hubble. Remember the photos that the Hubble had generated, or the photos you would now see about the Hubble. It was photos taken at different light levels, and then they put the photo together from the various light images that they've got to give you the best representation of said particular visualization, meaning what it would look like to your eye. So in year six, the Hubble took a photo of an hourglass shaped nebula. Now, this Hubble snapshot of Mycion 18, literally is MYCN 18, was a young planetary nebula that revealed that the object had an hourglass shape with an intricate pattern of etchings in its walls. A planetary nebula, obviously, is also is the glowing relic of a dying sun-like star. Just letting you know that that obviously means that that system's star had passed away, had probably died. In terms of the description of how that happens, is it explosion? Is it just switching off and just hanging there? What is it? Now, the results of this photo that were observed obviously by Nebula, not by Nebula, by Hubble, was that the results are of great interest because they shed new light on the poorly understood ejection of stellar matter that accompanies the slow death of sun-like stars. According to one theory on the formation of planetary nebulae, The hourglass shape is produced by the expansion of a fast stellar wind within a slowly expanding cloud, which is denser near its equator than near its poles. So, primarily, there's a lot of energy being given off in the center than at the furthest ends of said particular, the furthest ends of said particular activity that is being observed by the Hubble. Now, just providing you with that particular snapshot of what the Hubble had taken photos of, had recorded for us, had also sent back. It also had taken photos of lovely galaxy photos. There's one that looks like a cataract, apparently. They don't call it a cataract, sorry. I read it almost here as a cataract, but it actually means the name Carinae. Or the full name is actually Eta Carinae, which is a supermassive star. This was taken in year 7, where the Hubble captured a huge billowing, the photo of a huge billowing pair of gas and dust clouds in the stunning, and in this particular Hubble photo, of a supermassive star known as Eta Carinae. And even though Eta Carinae is more than 8,000 light years away, structures 10 billion miles across itself, which is about the diameter of our solar system, can also be identified or distinguished. They could observe dust lanes, tiny condensations, and even strange radial streaks of that appeared within the particular activity of the photo that was taken by the Hubble. Now, Eta Carinae is the site of a giant outburst of about 150 years ago, when it became one of the brightest stars in the southern sky, and although the star released as much visible light as a supernova explosion, it survived the outburst. Somehow, the explosion also produced two polar lobes and a large, thin equatorial disk, all moving outward at about 1.5 million miles per hour, which is pretty fast. And then there is the year 9 photograph of the Southern Ring Nebula NGC 3132. Now, on that particular note, dear listeners, we quickly take a short musical break because we're about this close to the end of our discussion. After that, we'll say our goodbyes and also to remind you to stay on during the rest of your Sunday morning sessions or the rest of your Sunday programming in our company here at Eagle FM. We're back right after this.
Yeah. Let's do that again.
And right there, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end for this morning's discussion here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. This has been my Sunday morning take. You've got to stay tuned for the rest of the programming to follow after the break. And obviously, we'll see each other again during the course of the week, as we always do on the home run. We will provide you with the interesting conversations. Obviously, I try my best to stay serious. And obviously, the particular analysis that will also accompany or bring along in that scenario. On that note, we'll be back, or not we'll be back, but stay tuned for the rest of your programming following after this.